So, last week we were very, very surprisingly interactive. So, do you have any comments or thoughts or experiences that you want to start with, or shall I jump right in? Yes, Rania.
Do we want to go back into the discussion of free will?
I don't think, no, I guess Victor says no, but but you know what? Whether we do or not is karmically determined 5,000 years ago. I don't see any point in going forward if there's questions still in the air. I'm so sorry. So go ahead, Sir Anya. And then we'll decide afterwards. Okay.
I have a hard time understanding how it's determined 5,000 years ago.
Gee, I don't know why you would have any trouble with that, Sir Anya. It's crystal clear to me. Okay, go ahead.
And it just seems that every time, it seems to me that every time we come to a crossroads, a decision, that we have the free will to make that decision in an upward movement or a downward movement. But I can see how our past karma or our past decisions would influence it. So if I've made a negative decision every time before, then the tendency this time would be to move in that direction. But that I still have free choice, in a sense, you know, I might, by chance, make a more positive choice this time and move in a more positive direction. And otherwise, how is it? Who makes the decision? You know, if it's not me, who makes the decision? Because I can't see that God would make some people's lives miserable.
Okay. I mean, the question of free will is debated absolutely endlessly, so the fact that we have to come back to it 2 weeks in a row, Victor, is only to be expected. And you might as well get ready to hear it 1,000 more times. Because it, you know, the mind, okay, I'm going to try to take it from another angle so it won't be boring, but the mind just sort of grapples with what you're really asking is, who am I? What is it to be a human being? What is my consciousness? You know, what does it mean to be an individual? What is my relationship to God? What is God? I mean, free will like becomes the crux of the whole issue. And it's hardly a subject that I can like really talk about, because it really is one of those subjects that you can't see from where we're standing. You know, we're under it, and we sort of want to look up and understand how the whole system works. And I think there is this sense of needing to be more elevated so that we can look down on it. So I think part of the confusion is the brain trying to understand something that the brain can't understand, that there has to be a capacity to be in a certain level of superconsciousness before you see how the pattern all goes together. Otherwise, you're just trying to read the pattern without enough of a perspective to read it. So I think that's why the mind gets all fragmented. Also, it's very, on a very practical level, it's very confusing. It's like, if it's all predetermined, why should I make any effort? But our actual experience is that we have to participate. I mean, that's what it feels like, is that, I mean, see, the real level at which we make decisions is on the spectrum of pain versus pleasure or suffering versus bliss. And our own the paths we follow are basically, this way I get an electric shock, and this way I get a little morsel of food. I mean, however elevated that becomes, that's what we're always working with. So we're always negotiating that reality. And that reality, on this level of consciousness, is extremely real. Actions have consequences. They either have immediate consequences or they have long-term consequences. And we seem to know that. We know that the things I do bring certain results in my life, and we gradually try to train ourselves by those experiences, or I should say, those experiences gradually train us, just literally like rats in a maze. And so what we're always working with is the extent to which our own actions influence our own experience. And then also we gradually lay over that a certain philosophical understanding, which then tells us that there are cause and effect relationships that might not be entirely obvious. We didn't exactly get electric shock or a little piece of candy on this side, but we begin to observe on a longer rhythm, you know, more subtle influences, and then we begin to change those. But the whole spectrum is suffering and bliss. And then we can sort of ask, you know, how far does that go? Where did that start? Where does that end? But it's pretty hard to know from the perspective we're in because we just simply are not high enough up the mountain to see it. So many of these things have the way Master put it, even though this world is a dream, on the level of a dream, it's real, which is kind of a funny way to put it. But when you hit your dream head on a dream stone, you have a dream headache. And even though you might stand back and say, well, it's actually a dream, on the level of reality that we're living it, it's experienced as reality. And only when we transcend that can we look back and see that it wasn't really what we thought it was. When I was standing in it, I thought it was one thing. When I've transcended it, I realized it was another. So in our everyday experience, we definitely can see that what I do with my consciousness and therefore what I do with my actions absolutely affects the way I feel and seemingly affects my fate. Now, if we eventually learn that when we get all the way up to here, that in fact, you know, we were really moving on this track that was laid out a long time before, on the level that we're living it, there still is this necessity to participate. And the only way we can actually drop out of that participation is when it actually becomes an experience to realize that there's just nothing but God and there's nothing for me to do. And then what we have transcended is ego identity. Because it's because we're identified with the things that we do that we feel this cause and effect relationship. I was thinking about this in a very interesting way, which is a little bit off to the side of this, but it's related. Swamiji talks about how when you reach a certain level of spiritual development, whether you're an avatar or a siddha or a jivanmukta, when you have transcended ego identity, he says that you still act and your actions still have consequences, but because there's no ego identity, the karma doesn't accrue to any individual but is received by the whole world. So cause and effect is still in play, but since when Jesus acts, there's no egoic identity with those actions, there's no post of ego to which those actions are attached. And just thinking about this, in Whispers from Eternity, the poem that Master has about Jesus, talking about Jesus being crucified, and while he was on the cross, praying for those who had crucified him, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what to do, what they do." And I can't quote the exact words, but the sense of what comes after is Master talks about how this extraordinary blessing of forgiveness was set in motion by Jesus' action on the cross. And we've heard that many times, and it sounds poetic. But I actually realized the other day, thinking about this, that it was also literal. Because that was an extraordinary act of forgiveness. And it was acted out through the agency of Jesus, but there was no ego for it to identify with. So the power of that tremendous action just went out into the universe and actually created this, literally, a wave of forgiveness that blesses everybody and gives all of us the grace to forgive. Now, thinking of that, thinking in terms of when I have an action, I identify with myself. I am ego conscious. You know, one likes to think that one is less egocentric than one used to be, but nonetheless, I'm quite conscious of myself as an entity. I can't speak of not knowing which body to operate or whether I've eaten or not, self-evidently. So as long as we're there, we're going to be experiencing this sense of cause and effect. And the simple practical reality of fighting the battle of Kurukshetra within ourselves and seeking bliss and the avoidance of pain forces us into certain actions. Because on the level that we're acting, we seem to be in charge of our fate. And if later we learn, and we don't really learn that we're not exactly in charge of our fate, we're learning that the interrelationship of cause and effect is so much greater than we imagine it to be, that we're really, as I was saying, we're sort of riding down a track, and that the balance in each moment is going to just go in a way that if we had the vision, we would be able to predict, seemingly according to these prophecies. Now, there's another factor, though, that steps into this, which is, as Master put it really simply, karma doesn't work the same for disciples. Just to make it even more confusing, that once your life really belongs to the guru, he can intercede in your karma in a certain way. However, that too would be predicted, that at a certain point you would reach the level of refinement. Swamiji was told that his guru would be Yogananda, you know, and all these different things would happen. So you end up with two realities. One is you can, and this is how Swami always comes down to it. Let me see now how to say this. This is how he explains it. Freedom means to be without limitation. So we're asking to have free will. But the definition of limitation is to be ego-identified. So the only possibility of actual freedom is to cease being ego-identified. And as long as we are ego-identified, all freedom is an illusion. And that's really the answer to it. So the real answer is, no, you don't have free will, not because God did it to you, but because as long as we are ego-identified, we are trapped in the limitation of duality. And so, of course, we're not free. We're constantly bound by that limiting reality. And the only freedom, the only way to have free will is to transcend the ego. And people think that free will is about having the freedom to act however we want to act. But as long as we're acting from ego consciousness, freedom is impossible. Because the ego will always bind us to this dual reality. Therefore, the only choice you really have is to think about God or not. Because the more you center your consciousness and identify with the infinite, that is real free will, because that's actually taking away what binds you. So, pardon me? Okay. I did it.
Mm-hmm. But you make that choice then, to think about God or not.
Yes, and that is an exercise of, well, that's an actual act toward freedom. Yes, would Brigham know you were going to do it exactly on April 12th, you know, 2012, that you would choose a generous rather than a selfish attitude? Maybe he would. That's sort of what they're telling us, is that these energies can be perceived. And I know what Tidambar said the other day, which was also interesting, and he tried to put it this way. This is Swami's story about time. This is from the time tunnel. Okay? We think of time as linear. So if you're here, that happens later. If you're here, that happened then. This happens now. I mean, we have this very straight line. We think of spiritual progress, too, as linear. I used to be there, and now I'm more advanced. He's ahead of me. She's behind me. In the time tunnel, the book, you know, that Swami wrote for adolescents and for children, he describes how time is a circle. And therefore, as we become more spiritually advanced, we move to the center of that circle. And when you're standing in the point of the eternal now, every aspect of time is equally accessible to you. You're the same distance from any moment. And that's part of what makes, you know, we think linear. They, way back there, knew this way up here. But they, standing in the center, could see the whole circumference. And then you realize you're just working with another dimension, is what you're working with. And the way you get to that center is you shed all identification with all limiting conditions until you move into the eternal now. Swamiji, I have that story in my book, that little story about him. When he was from birth, really, all through his childhood, up to about the age of 9, when he would go to sleep at night, he would lie down at night, he would close his eyes, this great light would appear in front of him, he would gaze into that light until he merged with that light. And that's how he went to sleep. And he thought everyone went to sleep that way. Because, you know, you're a child, this is what you do, everybody closes their eyes. He just thought that's what you did. And he would go into a superconscious state. When he was nine, just to repeat his story, he became ill. He had fever-induced deliriums. He also said he was beginning to realize, he said first because of his relationship with his father, he began to realize that his father's view of the world was so different than his. And those things conspired to make him suddenly extremely insecure. And he had this desire to, and then he was sent away to Switzerland and left his family at the age of nine and was ill a lot. He had a desire to sort of be involved in like everybody else. And the delirium also made him afraid of altered states. So essentially he entered a period where he pulled back from all of that. Then he met Master. He became a disciple. He began to meditate. And as he spoke about it, and then he meditated it and he went into a superconscious state. And he said, as soon as he entered that state, he immediately recognized it as exactly where he would go as a child. And then he added this, because in that state, no time had passed. So he'd been living in the identification with the ego that caused him to be in this cause and effect. Everything is caused and so on. And then he went back into the center and he realized that the eternal now had nothing had touched it. This had all just been waves on the side. And he thought all these things had happened, but he stepped right back exactly where he had been as a child. Now, you see, that just takes it completely out of the way we think about things. And so I never like to end any, like, solid question with when we're more advanced, we'll understand that. But sometimes that is the truth, that you just can't get there from here. You have to go somewhere else before you can get there. But you can picture at least these things, and these things are marvelous to contemplate. You know, they just take your view of the world and make it really terrific. And then you come back to having to live according to reality as you understand it, and not get so intellectualized about what we're doing that we try to live by something that doesn't really connect. You know, we do know that the actions and thoughts that we have affect our life experience. And certain actions bring us bliss and certain cause us suffering. So even if we can't make it all consistent out to infinity, knowing that tells us what to do tomorrow morning. Is that fair? Okay, any other questions? Today we are in the section, after we straightened out determination becoming discrimination, which was a tremendous embarrassment. I was so amused by you pointing out to me that I was able to make a pretty sensible thing out of a typographical error, which I thought was pretty nice. This is typed wrong, and it says the third point on the essentials is determination, and it's actually discrimination. I won't go there. We did it last week. But it was quite fun. I wonder how badly the typo could be, and we could still make something sensible out of it. I think at a certain point, I was suspicious the whole time, but I never listened to my suspicions. Okay. So Swamiji gives us a list here on the first point of the spiritual path being devotion, which we've talked a lot about it in theory. And now he gives us some very specific points about really how to develop devotion. And reminding ourselves that the foundation of what we're talking about was a year-long training course in how to be really successful on the spiritual path. So what Swamiji was trying to give the monks through this course was not just ideas, but an actual way of life. So we need to really listen carefully. And we talked at the beginning, you know, about the right attitudes to have and trying to cultivate those. And now he's telling us the essential things that we have to have. And the first one is devotion. And now he's going to give us some really specific ideas about how to develop it. And it would behoove us to pay attention because 10 years later, when we ask ourselves why or why not our spiritual progress has been satisfactory, or when we vaguely wonder why we're not even on the spiritual path anymore, the degree to which we take these instructions seriously are really going to be deciding factors. Because even if Bhrigu knows what's going to happen, we at least have to act as if our own actions are the determining factor right now. And all good spiritual effort will bring us where we want to go. The first place, he says, reason must be used correctly by seeing all things in their relationship to God. And then he has this incredible quote from Sri Yukteswar. intelligence is rightly guided only after the mind has acknowledged the inescapability of spiritual law. I have so many times when I'm trying to help people understand, you know, the spiritual path and what we have to do, I'll quote this one, that we can only really be intelligent once we have acknowledged the inescapability of spiritual law. Now, in the last few months, we haven't been reading the entire Festival of Light because we've been truncating the service to be able to see Swami at 11. But what we've left out, unfortunately, is one of the key parts of that. And so for the next 4 weeks, we're going to have it again, which is the story of this little bird. And we have the little bird is the symbol for all of us of the soul's long journey from being manifested by God, getting confused by delusion, and then finally coming back again to our natural home in God. And so the little bird goes through these stages. The first stage the bird goes through is the mission. He's sent out from the nest, and his parents, in this case his divine parents, if we think of it as the soul, says, be fruitful and multiply. And what you acquire, share with others. And so that's like our divine commission. We are supposed to be instruments of the master. We're supposed to, you know, expand our consciousness to the spiritual, and then we're supposed to give that spiritual joy to everyone. Okay, so then the bird goes out, and the bird gets excited because, wow, look at me, things are happening. Now, isn't that sort of what our lives are like, whether it's the cycle of one incarnation where we're a child and we finally grow up and look at me, isn't this exciting, look what I can do. Or over many incarnations and we gradually get the capacity to have our relationships and get a nice house and get money and we sort of get more and more engaged in all of the incredible toys that are available to us as a spiritual person. And the little bird gets kind of puffed up with this, and he's having just a lot of fun flapping around. And he remembers that he'd had this commission, which was that he was supposed to be in tune with the spirit and pass the spirit on. But then he has this fabulous line, what else is wisdom except to keep what is mine for myself? And I mean, that I love to quote that as the devil quoting scripture. You know, I try to use it in reverse when I'm justifying my own selfishness. What else is wisdom except to keep what is mine for myself? Isn't that what Swami wrote? You know, but of course, it's a rhetorical question, and the answer is no, this is not wise, this is stupidity. So, but what the bird is entering into is the second stage, and that second stage is called the revolt. And so the bird has this idea, but look, I'm having a really good experience here. How can this be wrong? And so this is people who are having a really good experience being, you know, libertines, being promiscuous, stealing money from others, exercising their power, being big tough guys, and, you know, being very materialistic, turning their back on the church, you know, all the different things that people do. Going in and getting mine, what else is wisdom except to keep what is mine for my own, myself. Now the soul, at the beginning, you know, had some ideas, but then it rebels. It enters the stage of revolt. And even in the Festival of Light we say, and the bird held to this, even though repeatedly he lost everything he had. Even though repeatedly he tries this, it doesn't quite work, but he's in a state of revolt. And the interesting point is, you see, there's four stages described in the Festival of Light. The first is created by God with this divine commission. The second is getting carried away with the egoic pleasure of the thing and simply declaring what reality is. We just declare it. We no longer listen to the scriptures. We no longer pay attention to the saints. We don't listen to our elders. We're the first young people in the world to have ever discovered sexuality, and we know about it, and nobody else knows, and everything people tells us, you know, we've all been through it, either in a massive or in a tiny scale. We just set ourselves up in a certain way. We revolt, and we stick with that for a long time, even though repeatedly we lost everything we had. Until finally, and the little bird's brief day is like eons of our time. So how many incarnations? You know, it takes so many millions and millions of incarnations to run all through all of this. Finally, the cause and effect relationship of our own actions and our own suffering begins to cross our mind. And then it enters with great force And finally, we enter the third stage of the journey, which is not knowledge, but the quest. And the quest is really a lot where we are right now. And the quest is when we're no longer in revolt, but we actually become genuinely interested in what is really true. And we're suddenly willing to question our first premises and wonder if our experience has really been, you know, as objective as we thought it was or as broad as we pretended it to be. And maybe there is somebody wise who could tell me something. We're no longer rebelling. We're genuinely trying to find out. And, you know, there's lots of different ways to ask questions. And you can ask questions in a spirit of revolt, or you can ask questions in a spirit of, I really want to know. I am really interested. So then we go through that whole stage, and this is where we gradually begin to come to what Sri Yukteswar says here. We finally realize that there is something called the inescapability of divine law, that there are actual principles, divine principles, that define this universe, and it really isn't a matter of opinion. You know, we can have any opinions we want about it. Churches can say it accurately or make a mess out of it. And that's the principle. In India, that's what's called Sanatan Dharma. Sanatan Dharma is just the eternal truth. It's just divine law. It's just the way we're made. And yes, temporary experience may give you something else, but sooner or later. And I remember in the 70s, the early 70s at Ananda Village, when, you know, everything in society was being turned over by that generation, which was my generation of people. Sexual mores, you know, ambition, life, everything was being turned over upside down. And Swami Kriyananda was right in the middle of that, but he was no part of it because he was the representative of a very orthodox tradition that far transcended the social chaos of the moment. And there were a lot of young people in, you know, in great revolt against many things that actually should have been revolted against, being part of it. I can say that rather proudly. But in any case, I remember a particular satsang when some young people were challenging Swamiji, you know, what did he think about the sexual revolution, which was the marvelous phrase that was used at that time, you know, just this kind of promiscuous, self-indulgent way of living. And Swami surprised the group by answering. He said, overall, I think it's a good thing, which was not at all the answer that he was expected. But then he put a proviso on it. Provided, he said, I think it's a good thing because people are demanding that their own experience be the criteria for the determination of how they ought to live. That they're rebelling against somebody else's dogma, somebody else's judgment, somebody else's rules, and they're trying to make experience the basis for whatever values they have in their life. So he said, in that sense, I think it's a good thing, provided you're honest about the consequences of your own actions. And of course, that's the whole thing. You have to be sufficiently honest, sufficiently observant, sufficiently ego-detached. And of course, those realizations do not come in a split second. You have to actually pay attention to what works and what doesn't work. Because, of course, at that time, too, there was a tremendous amount of romanticism. As Swami writes about it, you know, we all want it to be true, so it must be true, rather than, and that's a form of rebellion, too. I want it to be true. But it isn't true unless it is true. I often use as the example of that the way the candle flame will burn your finger. You can have as many opinions as you want about whether it will burn your finger. You stick your finger in there, and your finger will burn. And nobody's doing anything to anybody. That is the simple inescapability of, well, divine law. In this case, the human flesh is burned. And we gradually understand that we just don't go putting our hands into fire. And that's a terrific symbol. And you really don't get going on the spiritual path until a deep part of you is willing at least to try to come out of the revolt and really recognize that there is inescapability and I simply must conform myself to it. And so this is where, and this is the beginning point of the heart's connection, is that the heart ceases to be blinded by preferences. But you actually use, as he's talking about this in the context of the balance between reason and feeling, that you use your reason and your intelligence to help moderate the feelings of the heart, and so that the desires of the heart don't run away with you, but that you can gradually begin to desire to be in harmony with God's will. And that's one of the first steps that we have to use. And the way he puts it is, the way he says it is, reason must be used correctly by seeing all things in their relationship to God. And so every desire that we have, every thought that we have, every feeling that we have to ask ourselves, how does this fit in? Am I just, you know, in a state of revolt and I just want my desires fulfilled? Or am I really understanding that what I really want is to put myself in harmony with divine law? Okay? And it's just a... It's an incredibly critical step is to move from the revolt to the quest. We don't have to understand more than we understand. And this is where we also get into this very delicate balance point where we might not entirely understand what we're doing or why, but we have enough faith in it to conduct the experiment. And that's what the scientific method, that's religion is science, is that some part of me believes in this enough that I'm going to try this out and not think that I can create my own reality here. Okay? Any comments or questions on that?
Listening to Sarnia's question, I thought of the little bird because it feels like we have a, like we're like pigeons going back to God, that it's inevitable we can't...
Homing pigeons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And that... We don't necessarily remember that. We have glimpses of it.
Right.
But we just innately know that in our soul, and that's why we choose pleasure over pain, because that brings us closer to God.
Exactly. And that's, in a sense, why we don't really have as much free will as we think, because we belong to God and we will inevitably get drawn into that. So everything else is just really a slight movement in that direct line. This is something that Swamiji also says. Remember the whole question about when Yogananda was a diamond, how long did it take him to get out of being a diamond that we had that discussion about some weeks ago? And Swami's answer, when I was able to accost him at the breakfast table and ask him, was in eternity, time is nothing. You know, what we think of from here as a huge amount of time is no time at all. I mean, it's just a whole different construct. So this whole incredible journey where the soul is doing all these things and we think that we're making all these decisions and we think that we're having all these experiences and we think all these things are happening, that's what happens when you step out of it, is you realize that the waves were just agitating endlessly, but nothing ever happened to the ocean. That's the other part of it that's so about the whole time and free will. If you imagine that a shadow over there is a burglar and that burglar is coming to get you, or that shadow over there is a snake, someone put in our persimmon tree a snake, very realistic and very big, that was meant to try to keep the squirrels out of the persimmons. It failed completely, but it scared the bejesus out of me. Because nobody told me it was there. And I was just coming in one night and, oh my gosh. And it was big, fat thing coiled around the trunk. And, you know, this real fear went through me. Like, how did that get there? How are we going to get it out of there? Is it dangerous? You know, and I crept up toward it. And then I saw its head. And when I saw its head, I realized it was a stuffed thing. But there was a lot of minutes, a lot of time there when there was this really frightening thing in the tree. But of course, once it wasn't, it never was. The fact that I had been so drawn into that reality and that I actually had all this tension inside of me and anxiety and was making all these plans, you know, and if I hadn't seen the head, I might have run to find Chidambar and say, oh, a snake in the persimmon tree, you know. But it still would never have happened. No matter how deeply committed I was to it, it would never have happened because it was never really anything but an illusion. So that's part of what's going on here, is that we are so committed to this happening, we really think it's happening. And, you know, forgiving God, allowing, you know, accepting that it all happens. When you, who do I forgive for putting a fake snake in the persimmon tree and fooling me? You know, there's nobody to forgive because it never happened. And a lot of that plays into this whole question of what we're doing. All that really happens is we have always belonged to God. We have never been separated. We have always been infinite bliss. We have never been anything except infinite bliss. And oh my gosh, for a moment I forgot. Because in eternity, there's no time. It didn't make any difference. And this is how Swamiji says over and over again, no saint who has ever attained God has ever complained about the system. The only people who complain are the people who are still in the system and still imagine that the stuffed snake in the tree is a real snake and they're frightened by it. Now, I don't know what you do with that, but it's just beautiful to contemplate, because at least with your imagination, you can use your reason by seeing all things in relation to God. So I'm upset about this and this is bothering me. Well, see it in relationship to God. See it on that big wheel of time, and that I've stepped out of the wheel and I'm just standing in the center. What does this really matter? Because when I'm free, it will never even be a reality. And the more we can train ourselves, well, to solve all our difficulties by lifting our consciousness to the highest possible answer, and not just use sort of psychological tricks and other things to kind of get us around it. Solve your problem by going right where you're trying to go. At least, you know, head that direction. And you might not get there always, but at least you'll be cutting the groove in the right way. And it will become your habit. And that's what Swami's talking about here. We retrain ourselves to think in a completely different way. And then over time, we become stronger and stronger in what we really want to have, which is this ability to accept not merely as a fact, but as a delightful and a thrilling and a joyous fact, the absolute inescapability of divine law. I had fun with that, and I've shared with you, some of you before, the exercise that Stephen Levine would do with terminally ill patients, where he would ask them to make, he would do these retreats with people who were going to die in what they would consider to be a premature way, or at least they knew their death was ordained because of the illnesses they were having. He would have them make lists of everything that they were going to miss because they were going to die, like my grandchildren, growing old with my wife, going to Paris, whatever it might be. And then he would have them make another list of all the things they were going to get to avoid by dying early, which are, of course, many things. You know, I'll never have to pay off those credit card bills. I'll just die, you know. I'll die owing them $18,000. I'll never have to deal with it. I mean, that's very, you know, comforting, right? Or I'm never really going to have to, you know, reconcile with my father-in-law or whatever. I'm not going to have to worry about being an old maid because I'll just die young, whatever it might be. And then, as it happens, that was the list that you worked with more, because that was the reason why you were trying to push yourself out. I found it very interesting when Swami Kriyananda essentially told David and me that we should really not think about ever living anywhere but Ananda Palo Alto, that the chances were pretty good that this was it. And, you know, prior to that time, there'd been a couple of two or three fairly serious moments when it looked like we would go on to another assignment. And personally, I'd always assumed we'd do more than one community, but it didn't turn out that way. My, it was so interesting to my mind when I realized we would never leave. I didn't have any idea how many little things I was expecting to be rescued from. You know, I just subconsciously figured sooner or later I'll just leave this, so I'll never have to get along with so-and-so, I'll never have to solve the problem of the Sunday school, I'm never going to have to deal with that closet, I'm never really going to have to like this person, you know. I'm just going to leave them behind. Won't that be fabulous? You know? But not really. And what's been fun for me is more recently I actually tried to make that list. I tried to make the list of the things I could get out of. And darn it, reincarnation just had me by the ankles. You know, it's because how can you ever escape? So you get to die this time, so you get to face it the next time. Oh, wow, isn't that great, you know? You not only get to spend this whole incarnation struggling with it, but you get to do the next one, too. When I was really struggling to write that book about Swamiji, just having all these complexes, which by the grace of God I mostly don't have, just about being able to write, I just decided I would die trying because I was not going to do another incarnation on this. You know, we were just, one was like way too many. And it's probably been 50 million before now. But it was just like, what's the point? We use our reasoning to tell us about the inescapability of divine law, and we just buckle down and do it one way or another. Even if we fail, we just die trying because there is no escape. I mean, that can be terrifying, and that literally, literally drives you mad sometimes. Sometimes people go crazy when they're confronted with the inescapability of divine law. As Swamiji said, madness is a stage on the spiritual journey. He said, you'll get right up to the edge and you'll see essentially the inescapability of divine law, and then you'll just can't take it. So you just take a holiday and you sort of just go off and just be out of touch with total reality for as many lifetimes as it takes for you to come exactly back to where you were standing when you decided to take a holiday. I have some sort of like understanding of that side of life. It's, you know, everybody understands something. And I recall standing just before I met Swami Kriyananda, pretty much right there. Now, mine wasn't that I was trying to get away, but I couldn't figure out how to get into the reality that I was trying to get into. I couldn't figure out how to make the spiritual life practical. And I could see that unless I found something, no, let me say this differently. It was before I found the spiritual life before I found Ananda. I was just there. I knew what I wanted to do. I could not figure out how to do it. And I could see that if you can't change your consciousness, what will you do? And I was so overwrought. And I thought, well, I could just have a nervous breakdown. That would be like a solution here. I could just like get so cosmically entangled that I'll just have a nervous breakdown. And I literally thought, oh, you have a nervous breakdown, you go to the hospital, it's very tiring, it's probably expensive, it just disrupts everything, it's very disconcerting for all, and then at the end of the whole cycle, you're just right here with the same problem again. And it just seemed very inefficient to me. But I know that was based on having done it. Like, isn't there another option than just having to buckle down and change my consciousness? I think I'll just try. You know, and I don't mean to make light of the suffering, because it's very serious. But sooner or later, you must take yourself in hand, and that is the only reality that there is. Yes, Leslie has a question.
I have the million-dollar question. Just based on what you were just saying, I mean, with the anxiety and the knowing that, I mean, everything you're saying, I completely get it. It completely makes sense. I know it's truth. Uh-huh. So why can't I change my own consciousness? Like, why? I mean, why am I not transcending the ego? Even how can you have like such an understanding and a knowing that this is all true and not be able to like apply it all the time? I don't.
Because there's levels of knowing. Mm-hmm. You know, the first level of knowing is that it makes sense, both intuitively and intellectually. Mm-hmm. Then it makes so much sense that you're willing to change your way of life in order to commit yourself into harmony with that. But the first, I mean, it's like anything. You know, Karen plays the piano beautifully, and I just read Pride and Prejudice, and there's really ridiculous character in there, this aristocratic woman, and somebody else plays the piano, and they were playing beautifully, and she said, I too, you know, could play the piano beautifully if I had ever learned. I mean, and you know, Karen started playing when she was a little girl, and when I was at the point where I could have gotten better, I quit. And so she plays because she did the exercises. And I don't play because I quit, right? But, you know, I could have been good too. And so the skill of having right consciousness is more than just knowing in a general way where it is. It's just like anything else, only more subtle perhaps, but it's just like anything else. You don't master something merely because you want to master it. You master it because you commit your energy to mastering it. That's exactly what this course is about. Not only the need to commit your energy, but how to commit your energy. You know, I don't mean to single Karen out, but she was raised by music teachers. They taught her well. She had the commitment to learn. And so she put out the energy, and as a consequence, she knows how to do it. It's really not mysterious, same spiritually. Go ahead.
I understand. I have to do the work. I just got it.
Yeah, okay. But the other side of it is, and you should take credit for this, the fact that you're one, are drawn to it, and two, that it makes sense to you, means you've already done a lot of work. It's just you haven't done all the work. And so we just have to kind of relax and realize, like the great violinist who was praised, and someone said, oh, I'd give my life to be able to play like this, like you do, and he said, I did. So you want to be a great saint, you have to give your life to becoming one. And the good news on it is, as soon as you start, life gets better. Even a little practice of this inward religion will save you from dire fears and colossal sufferings. And that's just even the slightest understanding begins to change everything. Viraj.
But on the other hand, I keep being surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Yearly, practically, how often I think, okay, I've started the quest,
mm-hmm.
and then many years after, realizing, well, but wait, there are great parts of me that are still in revolt.
In revolt, okay. This is altogether. This is all about the linear versus the circular truth of this. See, we tend to think, I face this, I've overcome it. We think of everything as linear. I've done this and I've done this, but this is the picture. I find this picture enormously helpful. You know, the karma is stored in the spine, and we think of ourselves as ascending like this. So we tend to think of the karma, therefore, as in horizontal layers. If you have a pillar like this and you have horizontal stripes, this is my rebellion about worldly power. This is my rebellion about human love. This is my rebellion about whatever it might be. And so we're coming up into higher states of consciousness. We hit that strata, we think, and we fight, and then we think we've come over it. And then we're just astonished later when we haven't, because the stripes are vertical in that column. They're not horizontal. They're vertical stripes of uneven widths. Okay, and we ascend by a spiral staircase. And so if you're imagining that you're ascending by a spiral staircase and the stripes are vertical, at any one point you are in relation to a vertical stripe. How narrow or wide that stripe is depends on all of the karmic conditions that you've put into place. But you can chug along and you think, wow, it started, I was in the middle, and then it's over. And then you celebrate, you make a huge big deal. I conquered it, I did it, I learned it, never again, I've got this. And then you keep going around and whammo, you hit that stripe again. And maybe this time it's really skinny. And then you think, well, I just had a little bit of that left. Whoa, I'm free again. Then you circle around and it has a big balloon payment, you know, right there. So what that does is, for me at least, you just relax. And you justifiably claim that you did face and overcome something. You shouldn't be you need to claim what's true. But I always feel that there's just a little bit of humility and a little bit of a for now kind of energy about things, which I find, at least for me, does not discourage me, but actually makes me feel better, because I feel less vulnerable if I'm not crowing. Because whenever you crow, or even to yourself, and the other side of this is, somebody just wrote me yesterday or a few days ago, that they thought they had transcended this certain situation, then it came into their life and they just exploded with a vengeance, you know, with all of the emotions that they thought they'd overcome. And I would call them little dust bunnies of karma that were hiding under the bed, you know, and it wasn't until a certain wind came and blew them all out. You thought they were all washed away, but they weren't. And when that happened to me, Swami's answer to me is, well, this is good, because you thought you were free, and so you weren't putting out any energy to transcend it. So what good news! Now you've discovered that you still have more work to do. And it's just use your reasoning in the direction of God. You know, instead of using exactly the same facts to make you feel discouraged, that's what he said to me, just use them to make you feel cheerful. Oh, hooray, thank goodness it's been exposed to me. And now I know. And yes, until we're absolutely in Nirvikalpa Samadhi and totally free, you can depend on the same themes reasserting themselves. That's the other part of it. We tend to have karmic themes. Remember, karmic themes are just going to keep coming back. And usually more subtly. Sometimes not, but usually more subtly, because you just spin around and there you are again. Whoa, this is my old friend. I know how to work with this one. Yeah, and it's annoying as can be. Absolutely annoying. That's just part of it. It's fair to be annoyed. Oh, Lord, are we here again? It's easier if you don't keep a scorecard. Hunter Black is reputed to say, Hunter raised 5 daughters. And when was either the 4th or the 5th daughter was being potty trained, and when the little baby filled the potty and then brought the potty out to show everybody that, you know, the baby had filled the potty, and everybody had to cheer that, oh, look, the baby filled the potty. And then Hunter turned to Audie and said, are we here again? You know, and I always often think about that when just some little karma comes. Oh, I look at Divine Mother and I say, are we really here again? You know, I can't believe it. But, well, we seem to be, so. Om Swaha, let's start again. Whether it's revolt, whether it's attachment, whether it's just sheer stupidity without any particular name on it, you know, it's just the way it is. And the less shocked we are, the less ego identity we have, and the more it is just to sort of say, well, what did I really expect? I'm just not free yet, but, you know, compared to where I've been, I'm sailing home. Why don't we take a couple of minutes break? I just remembered, and I need to tell you, there's no class next Tuesday. So, any questions or comments before we go forward? It is freezing in here. It's like we don't have a heater anymore. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. Well, I've done one on the ways to develop devotion. We're going to be here for the rest of our lives. Okay. We will be here for the rest of our lives. It took him a year, so I guess I can. The second point he says on the ways to develop devotion is, whenever desires come, turn those desires to God. Feel that God alone is the object of your desire, and it is really him we love in any form. Everything that we desire are substitutes for that for which our soul deeply longs. Now, again, we have to really appreciate that a direction like this, an instruction like this, has to be seen as directional. Because one of the fundamental keys, which he doesn't have on his list, but it really should be on the list, for success on the spiritual path is common sense. And I think I was talking in this class last week or at some week about, you know, a certain individual who attempted to follow teachings that were way beyond his actual level of realization out of pride, thinking, you know, that a really advanced person would do this, so I'm going to do this, but the undercurrent was, therefore, I'm a really advanced person. When in fact, there wasn't an actual inner resonance. But what Swami's asking us to do here is to realize that the whole that we feel inside of ourselves is really the soul's longing to be reunited with the Infinite Spirit. And literally everything that we desire is a manifestation of that. One of the stories in the book I wrote about Swamiji was written, it was a story about, I think his name is on it. I think it's Krishnadas, and I think his name is on the story. But he talked about, he had two experiences and he paralleled them. One of them was when he actually struck his head. He fell and struck his head so hard that he actually began to leave his body. And he started down the tunnel of light. He didn't really have a full death experience, but he went a ways down the tunnel of light and was actually in the presence of an angelic being. That's the part of the story I'm going to tell. The story in the book was that when Swami blessed him, he went back to that same place. But the story, that this part of it was, he was in the presence of that angelic being, and he said, he was trying to explain that when any thought of shame or unworthiness started to enter his consciousness in the presence of that light, he tried to explain, it wasn't so much that he released it, is that it was vaporized by the light. It just was impossible to be in that light and simultaneously be anything but that light. And so any contrary vibration that would try to enter that light would be vaporized by the light. And then he also described, and now I don't remember whether it was from that part or from being blessed by Swamiji or both, he said he experienced a state that he called of absolute desirelessness. That there wasn't anything that he didn't have in that moment, and there was absolutely nothing that he longed for. Now, we use that phrase, desirelessness, a lot. I mean, it's used in Buddhism more. But it's really a very interesting thing to contemplate. You know, what would it be like to not be restless for anything? Because one is entirely aware of the fact that even as I am right in this moment, everything is as and I am, you know, enjoyable beyond imagination of expectancy. And just the wave becomes the ocean, and there's no place to go and nothing to be except what I already am. Now, that's the ideal. And then in between, I think I'll go get some hot chocolate. Gee, it's hot in here. Let's open the window. Have you seen that new movie? I wonder if I can, you know, read this book. I would so long to have a better place to live. My goodness, look at these age spots on my face. I mean, just there it goes. You just endlessly, endlessly, we are bringing forward these little ripples that make us something other than completely, exactly content right within ourselves. And so what we're trying to learn here also is to just start digging the right groove in our consciousness as to understand that really whatever we want is just some kind of a substitute for what we're really seeking, which is the complete state of desireless contentment in the presence of the Spirit. And we should use that realistically, and I emphasize the word realistically, to try to keep ourselves on track and not just allow ourselves, as people do, who have the money to indulge themselves or the energy to indulge themselves. The majority of people in the world don't even consider. When I first started on the spiritual path, I mean, literally, like I was 19 years old, for some reason, a lot of newbies imagine that the idea of overcoming desires is going to be attractive to other people. And, you know, it's just kind of like, I don't know why you think that's why you start there, but I started there. And I was dealing with a friend, sort of a distant friend, and more like an acquaintance, and I was talking about how, haven't you noticed that when you want something and then you put out this energy to get it, that after a while, you know, it just doesn't fulfill you in the same way? She was really with me. She really understood exactly what I was saying. Yes, I've experienced it. I know just what that is. And I was just about to say, so can't you just see that overcoming desires is the way to happiness? And instead she said, that's why it's so important to keep on wanting new things. And that's really, people notice that it doesn't fulfill them. So then they just figure, well, now we have to just start the whole process over again. And she was just, you know, it was a hopeless moment. But we need to be able to just be constantly observant of the process. Is this really going to bring me what I want? And even if, and Swamiji often talks about this, you know, it's all right to move through this world. We have to have petty entertainments. And Swami Kriyananda sets us a very balanced example. He goes shopping, he buys a new shirt, he goes out to a nice restaurant. You know, he used to go to movies. We went to the LA Auto Show and he looked at all the cars. He was shopping for a car, trying to see which car would be the best. You know, it's all right to move like this because we have to. We are embodied beings and there's a certain amount that we have to do. Plus, you cannot simply suppress everything. You know, sometimes you have to know how much tension you can apply. It's like when you're growing a little tree and you want to bend it in a certain direction, you can bend it. We're training these vines here to grow on the wall, and you can bend them a certain distance, but if you push them too hard, they'll just snap, and then you won't have anything that can grow. So we have to realize that the inclinations of our nature need to be guided, but they have to be guided with just the right amount of force. But even as we're living out whatever it is that we're desiring, we can always just keep it in mind. Just watch, you know, what does this really mean to me? Why do I really want this? And then just gradually, slowly, you know, just find that which is the divinely inspired balance for all of this. You know, Swamiji always, he always enjoys when people are nicely dressed. And, you know, it's not like we, in, and what I'm trying to say is, let me say it more exactly. The way Master described this path is he said that, and he talked about his devotion to St. Francis, whom he called his patron saint. He said St. Francis worshipped Lady Poverty because that was appropriate for his mission. He said, I worship Lady Simplicity. And simplicity, I began to realize, because I would watch Swami Kriyananda, and I still watch him, spend more money sometimes and do more things than I at first thought he ought to. I had a very sort of narrow concept. But I realized that he's moving through the world at the exact level that matches his energy flow. And he's doing and getting and relating in exactly the right way that doesn't burden him but works for him. You know, I've had a real experience of that. I just realize how exact this is. You know, I wear now this blue habit all the time. And you all know a year ago, I put all my clothes in the guest room and many of you all came and just picked up everything that I'd accumulated over the last 25 years and it all went away. And it was exactly the right thing to do. I've enjoyed it completely. But I still put on makeup in the morning. And I sort of think to myself, what an anomaly, but I still do it. But I actually realized this. Clothes and jewelry occupied my consciousness. I would shop, I would think about it, I would dress carefully, I would change clothes if I didn't like it, I would do this, I would do that, I was always playing with it. And a piece of my mind was often really into it. But the makeup I put on, because my face is so pale and everybody has to look at me, I never shop, I never think about it, I never vary it, I just get up in the morning and I do it and it's gone. It doesn't occupy my consciousness. One made my life more complex. And, you know, and but I couldn't, even though I thought for years of going into some religious uniform, like Vanamali Devi, when I first saw her, and she always dresses in that lavender color for Krishna, and she has her three or four little outfits, although it was so charming. She's a, some of you know her. She's a devotee from Rishikesh, a very good friend of Ananda. She stayed with us last year. And I'd always just admired the incredible simplicity of what she wore, which is not dissimilar to the way I dress now. And she came, and she was going to do a program, and she said, I have a new outfit for tonight. And it was corduroy and had a little vest or something like that. But I thought women just never give up. It's just always the same, no matter what. But I was so charmed also, because it was just so spontaneous and natural. You know, it wasn't suppressive. It was just the way things are. So Swamiji, you know, will have a lot of the latest gadgets and he'll be trying this thing and he'll be trying that thing, much less so than he used to. But for him, that's his simplicity. It's very expansive. He's always checking out what Dwapara Yuga is doing. He's always testing this new thing. He's always trying this new healing device or this, you know, new method of doing the new camera, the new this. And it doesn't clutter his mind to do it. That's simple for him, you see. So we have to sort of think for ourselves where the right balance point is. Then the next thing you have to ask is how far and how much you can bend the sapling. Because it's far better to just bend it a little and have it remain vibrant than to imagine that if you push it really hard, you'll get more, because you won't. You'll break it off. And every year we neglect to either support the apples, the apple branch, the tree, the branch of the tree, or to thin the apples, and there get too many apples on there, and we lose a branch. It's just so, like, how could we be so stupid as to do this again? But that's a very good example of what happens if you push yourself too hard. But always remember, there's God really that I love, and eventually, even if you're doing it like over and over again, just say to yourself, sooner or later I'll understand this. Or you can say, this is just one of my little petty enthusiasms. That's what I used to say to David about my wardrobe. Okay, so when we die, I will have spent $20,000 more on clothes than I needed to. That's all right. We're just going to live with that, okay? you're right, I don't really need these many shoes, but I like them, you know, it's my hobby. But we always know, this is not really, because this is the last point on this, we don't ever really imagine that this will give us happiness. This will be distracting and sort of fun for a while, a harmless entertainment. I sometimes think of it, many of you remember years ago when we lived in the apartments and we changed the carpet and we went through this whole long thing changing into this golden color, incredible saga to get the carpet, get the right color, have it shipped, get it put in. And the moment when finally the new carpet was in, it was just like such a, we'd been so anticipating it. I remember so vividly going in and there was the new carpet. And it made me, I mean, it didn't even do anything because it just sat there. You know, it didn't have the slightest, as I put it, capacity to love me back. It just didn't do anything. And I sort of lay on it and I looked at it. I remember sort of being upstairs and lying on the stairs and looking down. And then I finally said, oh, piffle, and just went about my life. You know, it was just hopeless. But that's what we need to keep, you know, if we have these experiences, we just have to keep reminding ourselves. Or you also go the other way. You just see the divine through it. You just always see the divine through it. I buy this because it's a celebration of Divine Mother, and I put it here. And I mean, whether it's a flower or a vase or a dress or a husband or whatever it might be, you know, it's just like this is a celebration of the divine, and through it, I'm experiencing the divine. I'm not going to say that it itself is in itself an actual fulfillment. So you do it both ways. Okay, any comment about that? Because these are really, really important. And then I'll do one more, and then, yes, Edwin.
So you're saying it's all right to have a lot of things as long as it doesn't make you happy. I mean, let's put it, you can have everything as long as. You know.
I think that falls under missing the point. Did you actually mean to say something else?
I meant to say you can have not everything, but you know the things you need as long as you're not attached to it.
And well, as long really what this means is always realize that I will never be fully satisfied until my heart is at rest in God. And so, even though I may indulge this desire or have this beautiful thing, you just take it, hold it lightly. And don't exaggerate the possibilities of how happy this will make you. I mean, it's easier to think like this about a pair of shoes. It's much harder to think about it as having a husband or a wife. You know, I mean, some things have a much bigger grip on us than others. So you kind of practice on the easier things and then imagine that someday you'll be able to get to the bigger things. You know, and you do. You learn step by step, but you have to bend the branch accordingly. But it's not more spiritual to disdain everything. You have to always be happy. Everything should make you happy. Swamiji often remarks that people would say, oh, Master loved mangoes, Master liked to collect umbrellas, you know, Master liked the certain tree, the Master liked curry. Swami said, Master liked everything. You know, everything gave him joy. And so it was very easy for him to express that joy through mangoes or curry or Indian music or anything, because he loved everything. So it's whatever you love, love it as the divine. Whatever you have, love it as the divine. And then you have both the experience of the thing, but you're also elevating your experience of it until you realize that you don't need that thing to love the divine. And that ends up being everything. You know, family, money, health, that at first you love God through it, and then you realize that you can love God even without it. And that's really how it works. In the Nayaswami vow, since I referred to it, the line says, I will never marry, or if I have a partner, I will know that my partner belongs only to God. And so you do have a partner. I mean, many of us, this was part of the becoming Nayaswamis, is it wasn't necessary to renounce our partners. That was a big change. However, the real thought is, I mean, it's an interesting juxtaposition. I sort of joke about it. Sometimes I think I will never marry, or oops, if I happen to have a husband, you know, like, what do you know? There's a husband there. but the emphasis, or he says the same to me, the emphasis is I don't long for this, but if it is in my life, I will see it as a gift from God, and I will never consider it my own. You know, the husband is there, the relationship is there, but I will see my partner as belonging only to God. And of course, if you have something that belongs to God, you have to treat it very, very carefully. You know, if God gave you a glass sphere, literally, if somehow he could and would hand it to you and you were supposed to care for it, you would be very attentive to that. And you would be very anxious to make sure that it was always well taken care of. So if you have a partner and that partner belongs to God, then you have to be very attentive to treating it correctly. So again, see, these are ways that you turn your mind, whatever it might be, if it's your home, your family, your new car, whatever it is, you treat it well because everything is a manifestation and a gift from God. So you don't disdain it at all, just the opposite. I was trying to teach my teenage nephew, you know, just like the way he just would throw his things on the floor. I mean, I know this is a factor of teenagers. You know, just put his jacket on the floor of the car and put his feet on it. And just trying to, just get him to respect it. Just, you know, it's, everything should be respected. I know when I would try to teach people to cook, I would try to get them to understand, you have to respect what you're working with. You know, here's a carrot, and God made this carrot, and it's a very nice carrot. And if you're going to use it, you chop it up, but there's a you have a relationship with it. You respect it because it's from God. And if everything in your world becomes like that, then you're really desiring nothing except God, and it becomes easier and easier for things to fall away from you. And it's very interesting to watch because, I mean, a lot of other things follow from this. You know, frugality, tidiness, cleanliness, all these things, because you have to respect these. Everything comes from God. It's not really yours. You behave very differently. Make sense? Okay. Any other questions or thoughts? Okay. I'm going to just... No, I don't think there's anything more I have time to say. That sort of ate up the last few minutes there, but that was good. All right, great souls. Enjoy your week. I guess I won't see you next Tuesday, but I'll see you the last... whatever that is, you know, whatever it is. Next week, not. The week after, yes. Time is circular, the eternal now. 2 weeks. 2 weeks. Good works. Thank you, Amra.